We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
This is Ryan Dawson of Anti-Neocons, and with me back again today is Grant F. Smith. He is the director of the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. That's IRMEP. You can find it online on the link below. He's the author of several books, which are in our new library. My favorite one is Divert. I hope you guys can go and pick that up. Grant, welcome back. It's been a long time since you've been on the show.
It's been a while, Rye, but again, thanks for having me back.
I think the last time we did an interview was on maybe Sibel's show. We talked about Philip Nozette and yep. Numick.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's all in the same theme, isn't it?
So, fortunately or unfortunately, I'm not sure.
Right. Well, someone has to do it. And believe me, nobody else is really on this. So not many anyway.
I mean, between you and Jeff Blankford, I mean, sadly, not enough really sticking on this. I didn't see a lot of media of Jonathan Pollard getting out of jail, which is what I want to talk about today or tonight.
Great.
Yeah. Well, we got to give us some media. You were writing about it before it happened, sort of anticipating that he was going to get out. But before we talk about that, I'd like to explain who is Jonathan Pollard, what did he do, why should he still be in jail?
Sure. Well, Jonathan Pollard was a naval analyst, and he was recruited, although he definitely had inklings ever since the 1970s when he went to Israel to become a spy for Israel, but became a spy for Israel, used his courier status as a naval intelligence officer to obtain DIA, CIA, NSA, and all sorts of other files, which he would remove from his secure facility, take over to a safe house where the Israelis would photocopy it and probably in analog form, get it all photographed and packed off to Israel.
Spike Bowman pointed out that they had so many documents that they had to get two copiers in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned Spike Bowman, who was one of the high Justice Department officials who we had at a conference a couple years ago, explain to the best of his ability in terms of still not being able to talk about some classified memorandums, such as a memorandum in aid of sentencing that was done by Caspar Weinberger, the former Secretary of Defense. But anyway, room size, volume of highly classified documents that the Israelis obtained from Pollard. So in essence, he was, in this so-called year of the spy, where there were other spies being rolled up, he was caught, and there was a great deal of publicity at the time about, you know, this great spy for Israel. Wolf Blitzer did a number of pieces on Jonathan Pollard, ultimately wrote a book about it, and there was, of course, a lot of media and media pressure campaigns over this. It's really an interesting...
Wolf Blitzer is a former AIPAC employee himself.
Right. He wrote, he was the editor of the Near East Report, which was originally an independent newsletter, which was essentially a way for the Jewish agency to funnel money to Isaiah Kenen, who was the founder of AIPAC, and keep him on the Jewish agency payroll while still allowing him to propagandize Congress and the media. But then AIPAC took it under its own roof, and Wolf Blitzer was actually an editor for that publication, which, again, it has a history that nobody really knows much about. But so he was a very curious figure to be managing public relations for Pollard. But like so many cases, he was able to focus attention on certain aspects of the case and away from the much more important aspects of it. And you could kind of see that in the current superficial reporting that's going on today.
The trial didn't really go over it either, just kind of vaguely said he did something very bad. And I think there was a moment where the judge pointed at the book of documents that were stolen and said, can you explain this one? He was talking about the Raisin memo.
Right. But right, right.
Can we talk about that now? Or
yeah,
that,
absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean,
well,
I don't want to go to jail. Right. I don't want to be like Edward Snowden or something.
Exactly. Well, and that's probably one of the problems, as it always is with a national securities case, is that it never did go to trial. It was all exclusively maneuvers in front of Judge Robinson here in the district court, in federal court in Columbia, District of Columbia. And, you know, aspects of that docket, again, such as the Weinberger memorandum, have still not been fully declassified and released. And so, you know, Pollard ultimately pled guilty, expecting that he would not, and in his own words, he told the judge in a memo that, you know, typically Israel was not punished for spying on the United States. He expected to be treated very leniently, and that his arguments that he was, you know, really not doing anything wrong would find a willing audience there. But then,
Is that so irrational? Because it's actually pretty fitting with history. I know you've talked about how Israel's above the law.
Yeah. I think it was a perfectly valid assumption, but he shot himself in the foot with Caspar Weinberger, who specifically mentions, listen to this quote. This was from March 4. Quote, it is also relevant that Pollard has recently analogized himself as an Israeli pilot shot down behind enemy lines and has stated his hope that he will yet be able to immigrate to Israel. Whatever else his analogy suggests, it clearly indicates that his loyalty to Israel transcends his loyalty to the United States, unquote. He really shot himself in the foot by doing so many interviews in the hopes that this vast publicity machine and Israel lobbying organizations would be able to put enough pressure on the government to let him actually do that. And very late in the game, he was still expecting that he would get that leniency. And it came as a total shock and surprise when Aubrey Robinson gave him a life sentence.
Now, he may have gotten the death penalty had it existed, but it didn't exist yet. In that,
well, he was, I believe the charge in the original indictment focused on not aiding and abetting an enemy, but rather giving an advantage to another state. And so, under the Espionage Act, and this Espionage Act has been totally gutted whenever Israel's involved, and we can certainly talk about the AIPAC case in relation to this. But yeah, so I don't think he was ever in jeopardy under what they charged him. It was Title 18, gathering and delivering defense information to aid foreign government. So they made a point that it wasn't, you know, he wasn't spying for the Soviet Union or something like that. And but, Aldrich and Robert Hansen didn't get death sentences.
Right. But that intelligence did end up in the hands of the Soviet Union because Israel turned it over to them, sold it to them for exchange of Jewish immigrants and other things.
That is what Seymour Hersh alleges. And that is what a lot of efforts that we've made to get files from the government also backing that up. But of course, the other side has muddied the water. His lawyers are claiming, and that's why I mentioned Aldrich Ames, who began spying for the Soviet Union, and Robert Hansen, who was, you know, spying since, I believe, 1979. They're claiming that no, we didn't use the intelligence as trade goods with the Soviets. Actually, all damage was caused by those two. So, you know, it'd be really nice to have clarity about this. And as far as I can see, the only person who has very sharply made that assertion is Seymour Hersh, and I respect Seymour Hersh and all of that, but it would be, you know, to me and, you know, others who followed the case, that is one of the key unanswered questions or key questions that needs to be further explored, because Israel really had the United States jumping through hoop after hoop after hoop, prioritizing this flow of immigrants, not allowing them to go to any other country, hyping up the plights and making sure that the U.S. was devoting all sorts of resources to it. If they were, in fact, also selling U.S. intelligence to the Soviet, that would really cast that entire episode of refugees, which is, you know, very relevant these days, in an entirely different light.
Well, it would fit, exactly. It would fit with the pattern, too. We know that during Iran-Contra, not only were they selling, with the U.S.'s knowledge, illegal weapons and plane parts to Iran, but also with Richard Perle pushing wheat into the Soviet Union in exchange for immigrants. So, I mean, that's been happening for decades. So it wouldn't shock me if Hersh was correct.
Yeah, a lot of self-service going on there. But when, you know, you bring up Iran-Contra, that is certainly a very big stick that Israel could have used, if forced to utterly beat back this prosecution. And, you know, the more you look into the whole arms for hostages deal that was set up and all of the characters involved, it looks like an Israeli proposal that was floated into the White House rather than a White House proposal that was floated over to the Israelis. You know, that's what I concluded in my book, Spy Trade, was that there was a lot of desire to sell weapons from Israel to Iran, especially to try and reestablish the very tight relations the Israelis had with the former regime's intelligence services. And so it looks like the driver of that entire operation was the Israelis as opposed to the United States. But like a lot of other things, a lot of the classified CIA files and very early files like Operation Elephant are still unavailable to researchers.
Well, that's what Robert Perry was sort of going that direction as well. And from my research, I was leaning there. It seems like they found a way to incorporate it with the CIA's interest in Nicaragua so that a portion of the funding, as we know, did go to the Contras, even though Reagan publicly denounced it. Privately, that was happening the whole time. The other portion was coming from illegal narcotics trafficking, and that's nothing new either. But
yeah, it's really interesting how a lot of the table is set by the Israelis, and then the U.S. is kind of tripwired into some stupid activity. Not that it doesn't have a lot of momentum towards stupid activities on its own, but it's very interesting. But anyway, in my mind, particularly after reviewing, an April 2015 NCIS release, Naval Criminal Investigative Service release, which we put it up on our archive, which is israellobby.org/Pollard. You can see it's got a little exclamation mark. Haven't written anything about it, but it's the first instance where NCIS has acquiesced under the Freedom of Information Act to releasing their files about the Jonathan Pollard investigation. And you can see how concerned they were with all of the publicity they were getting. I mean, the FBI does this too. They've got one eye on the investigation, another eye up above to see what's happening and what storm clouds are gathering in the political appointee land, and then a third eye, if that's possible, over on the press and what's being said about them, whether they're being portrayed as nasty people who are, you know, engaged in an, you know, anti-Semitic pogrom of some, you know, of some unit of government. So you can really see that. The file is the April 7, 2015, 10 megabyte file. You can really see that investigation, which had a very firm assertion that they will investigate. The investigation will remain open until all leads concerning the subject and Israeli handlers have been completed. Well, you know, it's categorically possible to say at this point that that never happens. There were many, many leads that they should have followed up on, but that they didn't. And of course, the most important one was the subject of a Washington Post report, and later James Bamford mentioned it, and that was who was tasking Pollard by date and document control number for a lot of these files, and why was it that his handlers tasking him had stuff that even he couldn't get? It was above his classification or his security clearance level. And that is, of course, a Mr. X / mega investigation. Major, major, major part of this story. That is what makes me believe why the Israelis were willing to sacrifice Pollard. And that's what makes it, to me, it's really not the exception that proves the rule. This was just another instance of Israel basically getting away with it by doing something clever, making all of the attention focus on Pollard and hanging him out to dry, and probably behind the scenes not allowing too much information to come back out about who was really higher up in government, embedded in the U.S. government, and able to access all of this information.
That's true also with Iran-Contra, other than Kimchi, perhaps. During all the trials, Senator Inouye from Hawaii kept putting everything that mentioned Israel into secret session, and they kept referring to them as foreign country A. They would never say the word.
Right.
You know, researchers are going to know, but the Johnny Q public watching Oliver North and the Poindexter on the TV, they have no idea. Just some country was intermediary in the weapons trade. And they never mention Israel, which is amazing because they're putting Americans on trial from the American government. But none of the Israelis even had a word mentioned about them.
No, you see that in State Department, contemporary State Department. There was this investigation called Blue Lantern of Israeli misuse of American weapons. And they still can't bring themselves to actually let the word Israel appear in the report. So the single word that's blocked out across the report, even though it's about one country, you know, is the word Israel. So not too surprised about that, Rye.
That's the same thing in the Plame affair. It was, again, foreign country A. I'm like, who is this foreign country A all the time?
Yeah, is it Albania? Afghanistan? Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, it was brilliant.
But it's not credible, and it's a sign. It should just have a stamp over the document saying extreme deference to Israel will be exhibited in following pages. And then, you know, then you can know. But they don't do that either.
Well, part of it's the fear, and I kind of blamed it on this leftist culture of any accusation of any kind of prejudice towards any kind of minority religion or whatever is extremely taboo. Whereas it's not even the case. I mean, Israel's a state, but it constantly gets conflated with race issues and things that shouldn't matter at all. And that's just part of, you know. Yeah.
But you don't make that conflation. I don't make that conflation. It's exclusively people on the other side who, when they look over criticism, they will remove everything that you've written about the Israeli government or the unit, and they will replace that word with Jews, as if you're making...
Which makes me suspicious of them. Either that's on purpose as a tactic, or they're closet racist, because who would think that kind of way?
Well, the conflation game is so key to the playbook. I mean, Netanyahu does it, bloggers do it, you know, people like Jeffrey Goldberg do it. Nobody calls them on it. They don't, you know, nobody's ever in a position to say, stop conflating this article, this charge, this, you know, this event is about this person. It's not about everybody of the same religion.
It's almost unique to Israel, though, because if you want to criticize North Korea, no one says you're prejudiced towards Asians or Koreans. It doesn't happen. It's this kind of mixture with the, I don't know if it's because of religion or what, but it seems to work for the Israelis over and over. Professors get fired if they mention the apartheid there. because that'll get conflated, which is amazing.
Right. Right. Well, it's, you know, it's a very powerful way of really keeping control of the narrative. And obviously people like Frank Luntz, who's done a lot of research for organizations such as the Israel Project, is a master of red herring, conflation, the straw man. And there are actually training manuals about how to do this. If you want to be an advocate, then here's what you need to do. Talk a lot about children, shared futures, and then do this conflation thing. And so it's effective, particularly since there is no opposing side that has their own training and well-funded, you know, research and talking points.
There's no equivalent Palestinian lobby. I don't want your opinion on something at the conference last April. Maybe they didn't approach you with this, but a few times I felt like there were some journalists swimming around there who were almost fishing for comments to try and get someone to say something nasty, and they couldn't find anything, so they just didn't write about it.
Oh, I can tell you that absolutely happens. This is an open conference, though. So when we do these conferences, and by the way, people can go to israelsinfluence.org and check out the next conference on the 18th of March. But there absolutely are journalists like that. We let them come. You know, we're not barring anybody. But unless they can get a really, you know, strange quotes or something like that, a lot of them aren't interested in writing anything about it. There's a great picture of a Wall Street Journal reporter who is interviewing Gideon Levy about his rather interesting presentation, and he didn't write a word about the conference. He was there, he ate the food, you know, that happens. But what can you do? We're there to educate, and people could easily, either from our clips or your clips or anybody else's clips, see what was going on at the conference. It didn't, in the end, I don't think it mattered that much that, you know, mainstream corporate media, which is, again, it fails every time it takes up this issue. You know, who knows what they would have done with it if they understood it. So not too concerned about that.
Nah, it's almost a mark of honor. If the mass media won't talk about it, you must be saying something true.
Right. But taking this issue back to the Pollard case, I think it's really interesting how the media was initially beginning to do what it, you know, segments of it always do, which was come to the aid of Pollard. In fact, you know, one very prominent piece that's clipped out of the NCIS file that they were worried about was the fact that Pollard, you know, it says that he was being presented with a list of 25 Jewish Americans and asked to identify each one that aided him in his espionage. Whether that actually happened or not, who knows? But there certainly were a lot of people who were helping him. There were organizations such as the BIRD Foundation, which rented out the apartment building that was used to install the high-speed photocopiers. There was an Israel Bonds guy by the name of Stephen E. Stern, who arranged the meeting between Pollard and Avi Sella in New York, this famous pilot who had bombed the Osiris reactor and became the gateway to Pollard becoming a spy for Israel. You know, they met at an Israel Bonds fundraising event. There were all sorts of people around Pollard. And so the idea, again, that maybe the FBI shouldn't have talked to any of them is interesting. And the other thing that's interesting is Pollard immediately got a job on Wall Street in which he was going to be working in a financial services firm. My question is, was he at Burnham? Was he working for Stephen Stern? I mean, who gave him that job?
Gosh, I actually joked about that before he got out of jail. I go, watch what's going to happen. And,
oh, really? You thought he'd go into finance?
Yeah, and now he is.
Well, you know, if this guy were a
Palestinian... He still can't go back to Israel yet.
No.
Yeah.
But if you were anybody else, the name of the firm would have been roundly discussed in the press. But this self-censorship, you know, this agreement not to publicize who gave him the job is very interesting, very suspicious. But that, I mean, that's just one example of the lack of bona fide follow-up on this extremely important case.
He gave all the Cygnet intelligence away. I mean, he talked about all the taps they had on Middle East communications and how to attack them. Like, all the plans were revealed is what he was doing. But I'm surprised they don't have the hubris to just say, well, yeah, I gave him the job, because you look at what Arnon Milchan did, right? Do you see what he did?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, for the full hour and 6 minute interview with Grant F. Smith about Pollard and more Israeli espionage and cases, go over to ancreport.com and become a member today. It's $5 a month or $50 for a year. Those subscriptions help me with the podcast and feature films like The Empire Unmasked, which is available now, and currently we are working on a film about Syria. Thanks for your support. I always forget to do this, but on Twitter, my handle is Rye Liberty. On Facebook, Rye Dawson. There's the Rise2Cents.com forum and Rise2Cents on YouTube.